Brian Beatty. The November edition of the podcast is upon us, and our theme this month is thanks, but no thanks. I gotta tell you, Thanksgiving is possibly my favorite holiday because a couple of years ago at the big family get-together, I won the wishbone break. And now my family never has to get together again. Wishbone, Minnesota is the small fictional town that is the setting of my friend Ann Panning's new novel, Butter. Ann's originally from Arlington, Minnesota, and I met her 20 plus years ago in Bowling Green, Ohio. We got together recently when she was in town to promote her new book and talked writing and stuff over some Indian buffet.
Yeah, that's off the record.
No. Oh.
All right. Let me finish chewing.
That's fine. So your new novel, mm-hmm. Butter, mm-hmm. which you're in town to promote at the Loft mm-hmm. tonight, mm-hmm. It's not a coming-of-age story per se, but it's about a girl coming of age in Minnesota in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. You were a girl in small-town Minnesota. You mm-hmm. were a small-town girl in Minnesota coming of age in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Is there anything about that time and place particularly that you're nostalgic for? Do you have a nostalgia for that?
Yeah, you know what? In a weird way, I was thinking, you know, I do think it is a coming-of-age tale, even though I hate that term. I don't know why. You know, don't we have a negative association with that term? It makes it sound too pat and too kind of trite and easy or something. But I think some of the best books are coming, some of my favorite books, you know, are kind of coming of age. But anyway, on that other note, to me, the book is sort of like, you know, I did grow up like in the 70s. That was like most of my childhood and teen years, maybe early 80s, 70s mostly. And to me, the book is sort of like a love letter to that. And it's not just like, you know, the kind of funky fashion and disco and music and Bee Gees and ABBA and all that stuff. But like, you know, a big part of the book is little businesses going out for big businesses. You know, like I remember growing up, there wasn't like a Cub Foods or a Sam's Club or something. You know, it's like people would still go, even though it was the 70s and it wasn't that, you know, old fashioned, people would still go and like buy. I remember my mom would buy bread at the bakery, bread and buns at the bakery, meat at the butcher shop, prescriptions at the drugstore, you know? Like, that was how it worked. And I do kind of miss that, you know? Because I'm a person who, I like, you know, the details, right? I love to go grocery shopping, but I've noticed, you know, it's not quite as fun anymore because it's like grocery / hair salon / bank / recycling, optician, what, you know, whatever. You know, I think pretty soon there'll be like a hotel in the grocery store. You can just stay overnight, wake up, go shopping. So I do feel nostalgic for that. Not just the funkiness of it, you know, the kind of loose funkiness of it. Because I remember I had teachers who were big 1970s goofballs who kind of end up in the book in some ways. And you don't see that anymore. You know, you see people, these were teachers who took chances and had us like, they'd have us lie on the floor and play the Doors and then write what you thought about that, you know, and that totally like opened something in me. And, you know, now my kids are in grade school and they, you know, if a teacher did that, I feel like they would get fired practically now for being so counterculture.
It would make the paper.
Yeah, it would. They'd probably get called in for a, you know, a very serious talking to, but I mean, that was a very alive time, sort of culturally and historically, and I kind of miss that.
Was it back then that you originally decided that you wanted to become a writer?
Absolutely. I knew I wanted to be a writer probably ever since grade school, but for sure high school, because that's when I had the really funky, I had an English teacher who, he had us write papers. He wore a denim shirt. Or no, he wore a shirt and tie with jeans, right? That was just nutso. And he wore a Tweety Bird tie or something like that. We thought he was just crazy. And he had us writing stories like, write your utopia, write your utopian world and stuff like that. And also I think most writers have a teacher somewhere along the way who recognized something in you, you know, and kind of helped foster that along. Thank God, because I wouldn't have, you know, my high school guidance counselor told me I wasn't college material. So having these English teachers who were kind of counterculture and saw something in me too that I saw in them you know, was my savior. I don't know what I would have done. It was the writing and also the sheer volume of stuff he had us write. And now as a teacher, you know, as a professor, I wonder how much he actually read of it. But he had us just blasting through notebooks and journals, and he had a library set up in the back where we could just, it was his own little library, you know, of cool books that you probably wouldn't find in the regular library. And that made a huge difference to me. Like, I remember I read The Color Purple back there, and lots of other books that, you know, I wouldn't have heard about, other that now seem like, you know, of course you'd know that. But, and it wasn't, it was the, yeah, it was the creative way he let your mind, you know, explore things. So that really did it for me.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the volume of work, because the one thing I remember about when we were in school, mm-hmm. when we were getting our MFAs, mm-hmm. you were always just churning out so much. I would sit and nitpick things till like every last yeah. comma had like scars on it from it
right.
inserted and removed and put back in.
Mm-hmm.
But you were just churning through stuff. And I wonder, does that come out of just that's how you learned and you just mm-hmm. kept writing new stuff?
It, that could, you know what, I never thought of that connection, but that could be it, because he had, it was a daily and a weekly thing, pages and pages and pages. And, you know, I am, you know, maybe to my detriment, I can really crank stuff out. And like I said, it can be a good thing. It's good. It's always good to write, right? Because you gotta get a lot of crap out there to get to the gold, right? But I also think because I write so much, I just want to jet off into the next project. Like right now, I'm in the revising stages of a memoir. I have it drafted. I feel pretty, you know, feel pretty close about what, you know, its focus and so on. But it really needs more revising. I want to go through and do an emotion cut words. Like I want there to be not a single emotion word in it, because it's about grief and all kinds of death and stuff. And I want to go back through that. But really what I want to do is write my next novel. Like I don't want to go do that icky work, that labor part, which is the revising, where you have, you know, the fun part's over and now you're perfecting and working, and you really do feel kind of more like a laborer when you do that. You sit and go through every sentence and clear it and read it and print it and mark it and read it. So, you know, it's good that I write a lot, but it's also bad.
Again, back when we were in graduate school, you were writing personal essays then, which predates, in mm-hmm. some ways. I mean, creative nonfiction did not exist when we were in grad school.
Right. It was barely, starting. Yeah.
I mean, it was like,
yeah.
Dinty Moore was at work somewhere. But yeah. he had not, like, completely blown it open. And
right.
brevity didn't exist, for sure.
Right.
And in the meantime, we've had this memoir craze kind of cycle through.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen the rise of MySpace and later Facebook mm-hmm. and blogs and everything. Does everybody have a story to tell? Is everybody's life worth documenting to the degree that we're documenting it, you think?
No, I don't think so. On the other hand, it all depends how you tell it. You know, I always tell my students, you could write a fascinating piece on shopping for paperclips. It could be so great, you know? It could be really actually interesting. I found out there's a paperclip museum. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you could... So, to me, why I love... I was writing... I didn't realize that. I really was actually writing a lot of nonfiction then. It lets me play with form a lot more. And I know you can do that in fiction. Intellectually, I know I can do that in fiction. But because fiction has the architecture of plot, right? And you just... It just has to have that certain structural refinement that has to build somehow, even if you're doing it non-traditionally. I feel like with nonfiction, it lets me play. It's kind of like a vacation from fiction, in a way. Like, one day I just sat around. I was, of course, killing time and not doing what I was supposed to be doing. And I was like, oh, you know, look at my eyeglasses. Oh, look at all the I save all the eyeglasses I've ever worn, you know. And I laid them all out, and I started looking at them. And then I was like, wait a minute, this could be a cool essay where I write, you know, basically autobiography through object. So I take each pair of eyeglasses and kind of write a little section about who I was then, where I was, what was happening in the world. And oddly, even though it's very personal, there's, if you follow it, there's actually political kind of stuff in there accidentally, because, you know, when I was living in Bowling Green, for example, the Clinton I remember Clinton was elected when I was waiting tables at Trotter's Tavern that night. Or like when I was in Peace Corps and I had these ugly round bobbly wire rims, we got evacuated for political reasons out of the country because of the U.S. air bases and so on. So it's like, if you have an object, they're already kind of historical. The objects become historical. And then, you know, it just kind of allowed me to play with form and content. And then I just think, why can't I do that in fiction, you know? And I think it's just because I get, in my mind, it just comes to me naturally, this will be fiction and this won't, based on several different factors.
Now it's sat down to actually figure out what those factors might
well,
be.
Well, I do. Know, no, I do. You know what? I don't write as much about... I've moved around a lot. I've moved around a lot, and I've traveled a lot, traveled abroad a lot, spent a lot of time in Asia, and quote-unquote exotic places. So, like, for example, I lived in Hawaii for 3 years. I find it impossible to write about the exotic in nonfiction, because... How can you, right? How can you not be like a tourist magazine? Even though I lived there, how can I get into some kind of nuance, you know, that, I don't know. Well, but in fiction, I can. In fiction, I can use Hawaii because I can show the dirty side. You know, like when I lived there, there were like syringes and tampons and medical waste washing up on the beach that nobody wants, you know, to know about for real.
Not a tourist
site. Right. But in fiction, you can take that and kind of parlay it in a different way, and you don't have to worry about the exotic. So.
Well, since leaving Minnesota, mm-hmm. you have lived in the Philippines where you were in the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go through this list, and I'm sure I've missed a dozen places. You lived in the Philippines during the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
You lived in Northwest Ohio when we were getting our MFAs at Bowling Green.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think you went to Idaho for a winter.
Ran a resort in Idaho.
Which sounded to me from the outside like something out of the pages of The Shining.
And it kind of was. That was a freaky experience.
And then as if to make up for that, you went to Hawaii for your PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And then, now you're at SUNY, but you also did, was this a sabbatical year? Or you took
yep,
some time
sabbatical.
In Vietnam.
Sabbatical year in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And now you're in SUNY.
And then,
New York.
Upstate New York. And then while we were living in Vietnam, we traveled a lot in Asia. We went to, because we were there for a while and, you know, not heavily busy, so we could, you know, we traveled a lot, like Singapore and Taiwan and Thailand. And then for a SUNY work trip, I went to China and spent some time there. And then we decided, why do we always go to Asia? So we went to England 1 year, and I have to admit I was bored. I don't want to act like I don't have anything to learn from there, because I actually probably don't know jack about England. But I felt, for me, I want travel to smack me with difference. I want it to smack me so hard that I almost can't stand it.
Is there a way that those different geographies have affected your writing differently over the course of the time you've been writing?
Yeah, and you know what? Here's the first kind of interesting piece of that was, okay, so here I am. This kid who grew up in a trailer court in small town Minnesota, right? So we were so poor at one point we didn't have a telephone. So, you know, that to me was poor. And we got free lunch tickets and we were on welfare. And, you know, that was poor to me. And it was very shameful and I couldn't wait to get out of there, okay? Because it was a small town and you couldn't escape it. So weird thing is, so what do I do after college? Somehow I got myself to college. Nobody in my family had been to college. And I just kind of found my way and figured that out. And then after college, I joined Peace Corps. And, you know, so here I am in the Philippines with, you know, people who barely have enough food to eat and, you know, running around, kids running around, barely dressed and not, you know. And I thought, why do I do this? You know, am I looking for some kind of identification of poverty, or do I, you know, I certainly have never been to Europe. I guess I just kind of seek to understand struggle more. And in a weird way, though I was saying, like, travel that smacks me with difference and makes me have to really figure things out, I, in a weird way, feel more comfortable, too, at the same time. I feel more comfortable in a place that isn't fancy, in a place that isn't, you know, like, I'm terrified to go to France. I don't know if I ever can. I don't know if I ever will. I'm just too scared. And, you know, the geography of the places, too. I mean, I grew up starting with a pig farm in Minnesota, and then the trailer court, and then this old kind of decrepit house. Place, to me, anything I write begins with place. Anything. Fiction, poetry, essay, novel. It, like, with Butter, that was, I knew that was going to be, like, my most Midwestern book. It is so thoroughly Midwestern, it isn't even funny. Like, it's, there's just butter and mashed potatoes and, you know, sweaters and farms and cows everywhere.
And as we sit here, I should mention that you are wearing kind of a gingham print shirt for your return to Minnesota
to leave
from the book.
I am.
And I'm wearing a plaid flannel, so I've got no room to...
I know. Look at you.
Given that place is so important, if you could live anywhere right now in the world, where you, whether you've lived there before or not, where might it be?
There's no hesitation. Minnesota. Minnesota is my mecca. I always hope I'll get back here somehow permanently. But it's funny because I don't know if I ever will. Maybe that's what's so, you know.
I've got a spare room.
Yeah, thank you.
Not for a whole family.
Well, I need for room for four. No, but it's funny because this is my place. This is my fictional home for sure. Like when it all comes down to all the places I've lived, this is my fictional home. This is even the next book I'm planning to write, which I want it to be a missing persons novel. I know I already have the setting. It's crystal clear. It's my sister's nearly empty subdivision that never got quite built because of the economic fallout. And it's going to be in the middle of winter. And because I was taking a walk in her subdivision on a Christmas night visit, and a big diesel pickup truck trolled up right next to me. And I thought, what if? How long would it take for them to come looking for me? But there's something about that empty Midwestern subdivision. And I thought, no, why don't I set it in New York? Because it'll be easier, because I live there. And I thought, absolutely not. It has to be in Minnesota. On the other hand, I don't know that I could live in Minnesota anymore and be who I am. And therein lies the problem. No matter how long I've been gone, and really I haven't really thoroughly lived here since I was like 18. No, college. I went to college here. But even though it's been, you know, decades, I still feel like I know every little inside nook and cranny of this place. You know,
although you got lost coming from the downtown Target to where we're having lunch right now.
This is true. I got lost within like 2 blocks of downtown Minneapolis. That's pretty sad. But I did get a cute new coat at Target because it's so cold. It's like, what, 50?
Anne's first collection of short stories, The Price of Eggs, was published by Coffee House Press back when we were still in graduate school. Her second collection, Super America, won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. And her new novel, Butter, is available in bookstores all over Minnesota right now from Switchgrass Books, an imprint of Northern Illinois University Press. Thanks for listening. As always, this podcast is available at mnartist.org, on Facebook, and on iTunes. You Are Here is a monthly literary podcast production of mnartist.org. mnartist.org is a joint project of the Walker Art Center and the McKnight Foundation. The mission of mnartist.org is to improve the lives of Minnesota artists and provide access to and engagement with Minnesota's arts culture.